I'd like to offer you a question. Where do you belong? How do you know that you belong? Have there been times when your belonging has felt like it was threatened, being taken away, or that it was fragile, and you didn't know if it was going to last or not? These are incredibly irritated and unsettled places where we feel like either we don't belong or the places we did belong now no longer have space for us. Today, we talk with professor and author Marlena Graves about that very thing. I've known her to be an incredibly fiery and intense presence in so many good ways. She is definitely that, but she's also thoughtful, and she is also deeply, deeply in love with the journey of spiritual formation. So today we talk about the restlessness of belonging, and we find out what I believe is that restlessness is a gift. So it's been a while since we've seen each other, since a while back at the Apprentice Gathering, but I'm so grateful that you had time to talk about all kinds of things today. We're going to cover some territory. So Marlena, welcome to the podcast.
It's always good to be here. And as I was saying earlier off the recording, it's such a great podcast and you have so much wisdom. So I'm really glad to be here with you.
I appreciate that. We've been talking every episode so far this season has just been about this concept of restlessness, partly about the book that I wrote, but more so just about the experience we all have, the very human experience of it. So I'd love to know a little bit about how that word is hitting you today. What is restlessness doing? What is that word, that idea? What's it doing to you today while we're talking?
I can think about like three parallel tracks when I hear the word restlessness. And so one is, as I mentioned earlier to you, but not to those listening, is that I'm getting ready to move. And, you know, I want to know what house we're going to live in, trying to figure out the school district for our children. And so I have about 3 months from now where I have to be in the new place, but we're waiting for our daughters to finish their school. Almost by the third month. So as soon as they're done, we're moving. We wanted to let them finish their school year where they're at. So I'm a little bit like restless about that. And when I start to get like, if I get slightly anxious, I just keep pulling myself back to Matthew 6:25-33, you know, seek first the kingdom and all these things will be added to you. I just care a lot. You know, I care about, well, first of all, we can't control our lives, right? Everything. But, you know, ideally, I have a nice community, a diverse community, you know, diverse school district near my church or my job, right? And I guess unless you have tons and tons of money, not all of those things could always check out, you know, and also try to do what's best for my daughters, which they have different needs. And then as I'm saying that to you, I'm like, that sounds so privileged. And it is, right? Because some people can only live where they can live. And I know what that was like growing up. I didn't really have a choice. I just lived where I lived. And there was no talk about children's needs or all the things that I just listed off for you. So someone might be listening and be like, wow, it's nice to consider those things. And I admit that that's a privilege to think about because I do have some leeway, a certain amount of leeway that I did not have growing up. When I start to get restless, like I said, I just pull myself back. Like, I don't need we're looking for a modest house, you know, so that we're not all tied up in our house so that we have money to give away and do stuff with, right? Hopefully live below our means. That's the goal. So I'm like, Lord, you worked this out every time in my life. And honestly, Casey, I'm less anxious than I think that I would have been in the past than 20 years ago. Or I think I have grown in my trust of God, knowing like you've always been so faithful to me. It's not to say that I haven't had really hard times of suffering. I have, but that you're with me and that it's going to work out somehow. It's going to work out, right? I already have a job. I already have a wonderful church that we used to go to. So that I don't have to look for a new church. I know people love us and we're known there. And so that's one thing when I think about restlessness. But when you asked that too, the second thing that came to my mind was, I think there's a good restlessness, and I don't want to say bad, you know, as you talk about, it's not necessarily bad, but a good restlessness in that for 10 years, I just could not get over that I needed to go to school to get my PhD. But I couldn't figure out how it was going to work out in my human mind, right? I'm like, this has to happen. This has to happen. This has to happen. And I thought, well, you know, I don't need a PhD just to have letters by my name, right? I don't need to be a PhD. That wasn't it. It was like, I need to have a PhD if I'm going to be a college professor or seminary professor. Some people can do it with a doctorate of ministry, but that's getting less and less. I was really restless for like 10 years, even though I was doing other really, really good things. And I finally prayed with some people actually that were part of Renovare. And they said to me, Marlena, you've been waiting. We sense that you've been waiting around for God, but God's been waiting around for you. Jesus has been waiting for you. Cause I think I had to have all this, you know, I felt like I had to have everything line up exactly. I'm like, okay. And when they said that, I'm like, okay. I'm like, I was like, God, you're waiting for me. That's, I'm kind of insulted by that. Really?
Don't you know me? Don't you know me? I'm never going to come over there.
Yeah. I'm serving you. Come on. After they said that, I'm like, okay, I'm going to apply. You know, it's like a kick in the pants, I guess. I'm like, okay, I'll apply. I have to pass this GRE thing. I got to get a full ride. Like I was listing all the things that I needed to do to get it, literally, because I'm not paying for a PhD in humanities. You know, you're not probably, it's not likely that you'll get a job, but praise God I did. So it was really amazing, but like 10 years of restlessness. And then like, I think it was in 2017 or 18, I wrote about this in The Way Up Is Down. I just got really frustrated with it. And I like blew up at my husband about it. Which is more saying about me than him. And he's like, I haven't told you not to go to school. You know, I felt really bad because it's like a volcano of a blow up because I'm an Enneagram 9-8 and whatever, just, you know, whatever had just tipped me off. So, and I apologized to him and asked for forgiveness because it was me, not him. Anyways, but that was like the culmination of that like tension. Like, what am I going to do? And it was actually after that I talked to the people from Renovare. But so that's my second thinking about restlessness. And then maybe the restlessness where there's sometimes a restlessness where you're just not content with what you have. And I think maybe that way it could be negative, but I don't feel like I'm there right now. But sometimes, you know, we get that way. We're like, I wish I had this, or I wish my book sold more, or I wish blah, 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 you know, whatever it is. So
yeah. I wish my kid was the star athlete. I wish my job paid us more. I wish. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's interesting. You talked about privilege, and I think definitely we don't always see that. The idea that you could move somewhere just to be in the right school district is one of those things. That's something that we ended up doing at one point in our life together, my wife and I, my daughter. Some of those things, we lose the fact that that is a mobility that not everybody has.
Right.
And on the one hand, there's a feeling of being trapped. Like there's a restlessness that comes with feeling trapped. Like I would love to get out of this situation, but I can't. Mm-hmm. But there's something else there too, which is this idea of, and I kind of hear it as you're talking about needing that PhD to move into this other place, to do this thing that you want to do. There's this idea of belonging that's in that too. Like, what is the community you belong to? Do you want to belong to that anymore? Do you feel like you can? You want to belong to this group of people or this particular role. Can you do that now? And what is it, you know, that good restlessness that spurs you on, you know, I can't stay here. I can't go back to not doing this because I feel it's a fire in my bones. But I don't have any idea, like, how am I going to pay for this? How am I going to get from this house to the next place? So I feel that word belonging is really powerful in there. Can you talk about that? I mean, you've written so much about the spiritual life and you're teaching in that area now, but you also carry with you the story of people of color in America. How do you talk about that idea of belonging?
Yeah, Casey, that's a real good question and fresh, because my younger brother just told me, I'm like, why didn't you ever tell me this? So I'm the lightest person in my family, so I can pass as white usually, or Italian. People think I'm Italian. Sometimes, and when people hear me speak Spanish, they know I'm Puerto Rican because they could tell by my accent. But my youngest brother just told me like a couple days ago that in our, you know, when in our high school, people called him the N-word several times, you know, like as an insult, and he got a couple fights. And my brother's like such a nine. My brother's like so chill to the max most of the time, right? I'm pretty sure he's a nine. And I was like, I mean, I had people say stuff. I remember one time, I think I've shared this before. I don't know if I've shared this with you, but I remember one time I was in seventh or eighth grade, and we were at the end of the school year where at least where we went to school, they gave certificates for like, you know, perfect attendance or whatever, highest grades and whatever, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever kind of merit. And so we're, you know, sitting there, and parents were allowed to come to these. And we were sitting in the bleachers of our gym, and my best friend's, see if you can follow this, my best friend's boyfriend's mom. So my best friend's boyfriend mom was there. And she said, I was like, I don't know if she was like, she was behind me. I was sitting in front of them. I remember it to this day. I remember it to this day. And she's like, I don't know why you're friends with that Puerto Rican girl. She's, you know, those women are loose and, you know, like whores and stuff, you know, are really promiscuous. And at that age, I didn't even know what that meant. Wow. But I just knew it was like something bad. I was like, you're saying this, like, do you even know that I could possibly hear this? You know, as an adult, I'm like, does she want me to hear it? Or, you know, I mean, I will never know. But I just remember just, for your people group, just be, I'm like, she doesn't even know me. Like, you know what I mean? Like, why, you don't even know anything about me, and you're making these judgments, which happens to people all the time. But I remember just like, I'm like, no, that's, that's just off. And I remember feeling really bad about myself. You know what I mean? Like, what is, and when I was younger, I didn't get the N word, you know, but people thought I was African-American when I came from Puerto Rico, because I was a lot darker. And I, you know, curly hair, and especially when I had a curly haircut, this haircut that I hated, this neighbor gave me, and a perm, and I had like a fro, you know, and people thought I was African-American, and I love fros. I wish I had it now. But so I was like, well, don't you know? I mean, yes, I see why you could say that, because I'm darker, but there's like African-Americans, there's people of Spanish descendants. They just thought white and black, which is not wrong. There's Asians, there's people of all different ethnicities. So I was kind of like, don't you know the difference? You know, I mean, there's, yes, I probably do have some African heritage for sure, because of being born in Puerto Rico, my mom and the slave trade. So I probably do have that. I have some reason actually to think that, but it's just interesting. But I think that might have been the reason that, like, I never felt quite like I belonged, because we moved back to where my dad was from in the country. And I just never felt like I belonged. But as a child, I didn't really know why. You know what I mean? I just couldn't figure out what was the issue.
Sure.
And I think maybe some race and maybe class had to do with that. But I still liked my school. My teachers were great. So it wasn't anything like that. So that's early belonging. Early in my earliest life, I felt never that I belonged. So if we can summarize that, I never felt like I belonged. And then I'm going to say this briefly. I did not grow up in like evangelical Christian culture or the subculture. I went to a Christian, which I now know is a conservative Christian college, maybe even fundamentalist when I was young. But my pastor's daughter went there, and they weren't really even from that same culture either, but It's a good school, they thought. So she went. And I'm like, oh, I should be mentored by Christians. I'll go to this Christian school instead of the Penn State, where I probably wouldn't have had any loans. Like, anyways, but when I got there, I was really like, I was like, I thought I was going to be in heaven. Like, I actually thought, I'm like, okay, this is a Christian school where everyone loves the Lord, you know. And then when I went there and I saw the humanity of people, again, 18 years old, I was like, what is this? You know, like, I was like, you guys are lucky. You grew up in a lot of you grew up in a Christian home. You had money and you're acting like this. I was like, what the heck? I thought we were gonna like value the same spiritual things. And of course, that's somewhat immaturity, right? It's immaturity because I didn't know. I wasn't the age that I am now and know that we Christians are human and make mistakes, and God forbid I can too. So I had, you know, these 18, 19, 20-year-old kids. I thought that kids at a Christian school that grew up in Christian family should have like a particular type of Christian maturity. So I was really, actually, I was disillusioned when I'm
Yeah.
like, if you guys aren't like Christ, what hope is there? So I think it's what people do now, actually, Casey. You expect there's so much disappointment in Christianity because you expect people, at least in a mild way, to at least to have some collectively resemblance to Christ. Anyways, so I think for a long time I didn't think I belonged. But and that said, it's actually in the churches that I grew up in and in the churches that I've been to and just meeting great people. I'm like, okay, I do belong. I'm not so weird, you know. I think I've always been a contemplative. But and people are like, you're a mystic. And I'm like, what is that? You know, when I was young, and I'm like, I just read the Bible. So like, well, am I mystic? Because don't the Psalms say to cry out to God? I don't know, you know, the difference. So I think belonging, let me circle to this, and I'd love to hear what you have to say about it, because you write some really good things about it. So I'm gonna throw it back at you. But like, I think belonging is of primary importance in the kingdom of God. Like when you hear about Christians excluding other Christians or other people, to me, that strikes me as antichrist. Doesn't mean you have to agree with them, right? But I just, like, I have family members that I don't agree with, but I know I belong to them. Like, I know that they would do whatever they could for me and that they wouldn't kick me when I'm down. But I'm not so sure of certain Christians, right? Right? Or professing Christians who would, you know, take joy, I guess, if something happened to me because maybe they disagree with something I say. And so that's so antichrist. But I think that's central. And I think people love Jesus so much because he made them feel like they belonged, like they were included. He did not exclude them. It doesn't mean that Jesus was like, oh, yeah, whatever you do is right. But people knew that they were known and loved by Christ, and I think that's how the church should be. And I think if we were more like that, if we more were more like that, then people we would earn the right to be heard. Just get afford someone the humanity and the dignity. And if I could do anything to make someone feel like they belong, I will. And that might be because I know what it's like not to feel like you belong for the longest time. So, and I still sometimes don't feel like I belong in certain places, right? I mean, I guess we all feel that way. But thank God I've had really good churches and I haven't had bad churches. My own experience with pastors in the churches have been good. They've all loved me, my family, but I know there's people that haven't. Now, I didn't say I've had good experience with all Christian organizations, but I have with churches. So how do you think about it?
I
Because you
think
write
it,
about
yeah,
it.
no, you give such beauty to that because it's you put it right on the ground level. Like this is what it looks like to wrestle with this in real life. And I think to our previous conversation about privilege, I think that privilege is a way of belonging. It's a way we belong to a certain way of life, a certain perspective on the world. When I
That's
hear
right.
people say, you know, reflecting on a news story or something, and they're like, oh, that neighborhood's really dangerous. Why don't those people, and they say, those people, why don't those people just move? And I think that's a point, like you belong to a kind of world in which it's possible to just pick up and go.
Yes.
But not everybody belongs to that. I also see belonging as kind of the, not kind of, It is that bedrock from which we do everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the thing we stand on in order to have a spiritual life, to have a life with God, to have a life with other people, a life with ourselves. You know, it's how we consider our own bodies, minds, and souls, and the realities about ourselves, both the dark and the light, how we look at the true self, who we really are, and the false self, who we're really not, but we'd like everybody to think we are.
Yeah.
It's the foundation for that. And also, I sense it's always changing. I belong right now to parenting a teenager. But when she becomes an adult, that belonging, that attachment, that connection goes away. And I become a different kind of parent.
Yeah.
So whatever I invest in that will have to change. I think early in our faith, we belong to certain pictures of God.
Yeah.
God as warrior, or God as smiter of my enemies, or, you know, even like an unhealthy version, like God is the smiter of me whenever I step out of line. And that gives us a place. It gives us a sense of belonging to a community, especially if our community believes that.
Yeah.
And then we hear that thing, or we have that experience, or we read that book, or we feel that pain, and we go, I don't think I can belong to that anymore.
Yeah. And you do talk about that in your book of the different views of God, which I agree with you is, I think, the most important thing. People have said that what your view of God is, your whole life flows from, right?
Yeah.
And sometimes I want to say too, like, certain community, I'm just going to use your words because I just think it's great. You know, the God is the smiter of people community, whether me or other people. I'm like, do you really want to think that way? I was like, I don't think God is the smiter of people. I mean, there's questions that I don't know, mysteries. And I'm wondering, you know, yeah, I just, what I know of Jesus Christ, if he says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. So the things that I don't maybe understand in the Old Testament, if, you know, I think there's mystery, I'm like, okay, there's something I don't understand because it's not really adding up to who Jesus is.
Right.
And I wish I could find an easy answer, but I don't. Usually most people, most philosophers have not. So, or theologians. So I should say most, I think all, I don't think anyone gives a satisfactory answer, but, like, why would you exclude people that don't think God's the smiter of all because they're wrong or something, you know, why would you exclude them? It's like, well, yeah.
It always strikes me too that it's always the smiter of other people.
Oh yeah.
It's God is the smiter of others, not, you know, it's not an equal opportunity smiting. It's that I'm, you know, I'm not eligible, but certainly the people out, those people or that group of people or that particular persuasion, they're in the smite target area, but not me with the exact same failures and things like that. And it's getting caught up in that metaphor, right? That we need that image of God because we belong to it so much that it's our only way of making sense of everything else. Or a God who desperately needs women to occupy a certain space in the church.
Yeah.
Because without that, the rest of the scaffold falls apart.
Yeah.
And really the scaffold is more important than the reality. And it's like we've mistaken the telescope for the stars. It's not the same thing.
Wisdom. That's wisdom. Yeah. That's so right. That is so right. And I guess that's another way where I haven't felt like I belonged with people like, you can't teach men about God or this or that. Like, I've heard people say that. I'm like, well, I can prove to you in the early church that women did, you know, teach men things. And so that's, I mean, as we've said earlier, just to make the point of belonging is like, the church should not, again, people like, well, if you say everyone belongs, then no one gets judged. No, I think God's going to judge people. I mean, right or wrong, according to their conscience, if they've never heard of him, like it's talked about in Romans, even Tony Evans said that, you know, more concerned, like Tony Evans said that, so I'm not off. I just really think that we're more skilled in judging than causing people to belong. And maybe it's because we want to feel better than others. I don't know what it is. I really don't know what it is. And so if I ever find myself excluding people, and I don't think honestly, I don't think it comes out like maybe. Okay, I'll tell you right now. I don't think like I do it in concrete ways. But in my mind, like, I'm like, certain people don't deserve my prayers because they're hurting other people, right? Mm-hmm. How else would you do for my prayers? Or people that have hurt me, like, but Jesus says to love your enemy. So it doesn't mean that I have to like them, but I have to desire their good and flourishing. And for some people, that means they need to be in jail, right? Because they've hurt so many people. But what I'm saying is, like, if I'm starting to feel exclusive in my heart towards people, it's especially for me, people that hurt other people, Christians that hurt other people.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if I start to exclude them from grace in my heart, I just like, and so from belonging to me, I'm like, those are not the Christians. They're not my people. Right. I mean, I'm like, okay, I have to watch myself because I'm excluding them from grace and I'm pigeonholing them in this one moment. They could change in the future. Right. Again, that doesn't mean there's not consequences for their actions. I don't mean that. But if I say, well, you're out because you're too legalistic and fundamentalist and I'm excluding you because you exclude everyone else. then I start to check myself. Like the Lord's like, okay, Matthew 7:1, do not judge lest thou be judged. That doesn't mean that stuff isn't wrong, but you can't make the final decision on their soul or, you know, whether they belong to me or not. But all that to say that I, in my heart, I can be exclusive to, and it's especially when Christians hurt other people, you know, and I have to really talk to the Lord about it. Cause I'm like, I don't want to pray for them. Like, you know, they don't deserve my prayers. But
what if it gets answered? What happens then?
Yeah. Yeah. Like Jonah, right? I don't want to preach at Nineveh because they might convert.
It might actually work.
Yeah.
Hey there, just breaking in for a minute. I know, commercials are annoying, but I wanted to tell you, the book that this podcast is based on, The Gift of Restlessness, A Spirituality for Unsettled Seasons, is available for pre-order right now. So if you're listening and you haven't done that, would you please consider pre-ordering the book? And it helps it get out into the world and helps it get into people's algorithms and all of that good stuff. But if you do pre-order, I also want to give you some gifts. And so if you are a person who pre-orders the book, or if you've already pre-ordered the book, you can go to my website, kctigret.com, and register for some free gifts we have to offer you. And I would love, love to hear what you think of the book after you get a chance to read it. So thanks for hearing this. I know commercials again are annoying, but thanks for listening to this. Back to the conversation.
So
a lot of your work recently has really focused deeply on racial justice and especially racial justice in light of the conversation of people of faith. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's a restlessness, a corporate restlessness around this right now that I find people either trying to ignore or mm-hmm. trying to move, you know, there is some code language that I hear, like, mm-hmm. It's not the color of your skin. It's not a skin issue. It's a sin issue, or it's a this, or it's a that. And that language is code for, this is how I'm trying to process. I feel like it's, and you could tell me if I'm right about this or not, or wrong. I feel like it's code for, this is how I'm trying to deal with my restlessness, my discomfort with the fact that if I acknowledge that this is actually a reality for Black and brown people, then I can't go back.
Yeah.
So if I acknowledge this, then I have to move. I'm in that present tense of like, okay, I can't pretend like this isn't true anymore. Yeah. And I think for a lot of people, George Floyd, that was the moment where I can't, whatever I hadn't paid attention to before, they mm-hmm. now know this is a line. I cannot go back to the time when I thought this was just an isolate, whatever excuses or whatever might've been given. But you've lived in this, you've breathed this air, both from personal experience and also from your research. What's happening? What do you see happening in especially American churches around people who are just figuring out or trying to get away from the reality that there's a huge issue when it comes to race and people of faith.
Well, that's a Pandora's box, I think, Casey, you're asking me. But I will say this, in my research, I'm extremely disappointed in, I have to say, the white evangelical church, because it's not the Black church, or the people that profess to be evangelicals, or even throw out the word evangelicals, people that profess to read the Bible and love their neighbors, like to hold the Bible high. Because I started my research for my PhD work, trying to find like the heroes, and my history professors are like, don't try it, Marlene. They're like, don't look for the heroes, because they're not going to be heroes to you the more research you do. So, I mean, there's going to be something where they will fall short, right? And actually, that's really good advice. We all like our heroes, but I thought there has to be, like, you know, a lot of white pastors. I was looking among pastors specifically from 1750 on that stood against the racist and racialized tide. White supremacy is a better word. And I didn't find very many people. And I was like, wait a minute. There has to be more people than this. Like, there were some, you know, if I jump to the mid 20th century, the 1950s and 60s, I did find 28 pastors in Mississippi in 1961, 28 white pastors. See, I can know who they are, right? 28 white pastors in Mississippi in 1961. But I was so upset. I'm like, why aren't I finding more information? Maybe I'm missing an archive, or like, you know, like a library full of stuff. Like, maybe I'm just not finding the place where all this information is at. And so, I can't remember her name. Her first name is Jean. I think she's at Brown, or she's a history professor on, you know, the long, civil rights movement and the Black freedom struggle. And so I emailed her. I'm like, okay, she's at a public, you know, a university. She has a public email. I've read her stuff in my research. So I said, hey, I sent her email. I'm a PhD student. I'm looking for, you know, white pastors or other people that, you know, went counterculture against the racist culture. Not just in the South, but I was looking in the South, but because that's what we think of race in the South, but trust me, it's in the North, and everywhere else. And she's like, no, she's like, there's pastors who stood against the racialized institutions and all that were an anomaly. There's hardly any of them, hardly any, like, when, if you want to think about evangelical Baptist, I don't know, non-denoms, Pentecostals, whatever, whoever you want to think of as the evangelical. And I was looking for white evangelical pastors. She's like, the people that you see in the mid-century civil rights movement, they were like Unitarians and Episcopalians from the North that went to the South to help out. She's like, as far as people there, she's like, very few and far between. You can cite some of the names and the women. I mean, there's some women that were not pastors. But I remember when I heard that, I was like, okay, so it's not just my deficiency in research. It's not that I'm deficient in researching. It's just like, I can't find it because it's not there. And so I was really disappointed. And I've had several people tell me, they're like, my husband included, and other people, when they ask me what I research, they're like, I would be mad all of the time if I researched, which I said, I am mad, and it's depressing. And it's angering when I read about the bad stuff that happens. And so the way I like to explain it to people, Casey, is this: at 30,000 feet, it's a complete train wreck. Like, it is a dumpster fire of racism in America, right? And I'm not just talking about individual racism. Contra the public thing, I would like to tell people that don't believe racism is structural to remember, especially those that are like, you know, we want Roe versus Wade overturned. Why do you want it overturned? Because it's ensconced in the law, right? You believe in structural sin because you believe that, you know, Roe versus Wade should be overturned, right? And I mean, people could argue about that. I mean, it's a hard thing, right? But I mean, obviously everyone, I want life, right? So anyways, I want to say, people, you do believe in institutional sin, but not when it comes to racism. And it's hard to see. It is in the structures, you know, with George Floyd, what you saw. I don't think everyone's a racist. like some people's like, we're all racist. No, I think we're all white supremacists, including me. White supremacy has affected us so that we think white people are superior in every way, you know?
Yeah.
But I think we're all white supremacists, but I don't think necessarily, like, I do think there are people that they're actually fine people. They don't think someone's less because of the color of their skin. So all that to say, it's discouraging. However, on the ground, there's a few things that I remind myself. On the ground is there could have been people that stood against the culture, but they didn't leave any historical artifact for me to know. You know, a mom, a grandpa, somebody, because they didn't read or write a lot. They're not, you know, I don't have their information. That's one thing. And the other thing I remind myself was, if you stood against the racial, you know, I'm talking about when there was Jim Crow and all that. I mean, these pastors in Mississippi, they got their tires slashed, white pastors, crosses burnt in their yard. They were called the N-word because of supporting people of color. A lot of them were driven out of the state. They ended up coming back eventually. Some of them stayed, but they had similar consequences because they were called N lovers, you know? And so, but when I'm on the ground now, like talking to people like you and other people, I'm like, you know, when you fly, the way I like to say, like when you're flying in the airplane, this is what it looks like from above, right? That's the 30,000 feet type deal. Like what I'm reading in history, complete dumpster fire train wreck, you know, toxic chain wreck, you know, East Palestine, Palestine, Ohio. But when I'm on the ground, I'm like, no, life is a lot more complex than that. There are people. So I'm encouraged on the ground. I'm encouraged when I go to different places or like to the apprentice gathering where I saw you in person. I'm like, okay, I'm encouraged by people on the ground. But when I look at like on a structural church level, I'm just disgusted by the lies, you know, national lies and things that people do to retain power. So I don't know if that was a good answer, but on the ground, encouraged. When I look at like how much have we actually moved forward, we have moved forward somewhat, but I feel like the church should be leading the way. And some churches are, but most of them aren't.
Yeah, and there's a, as you're saying that, there's a grief that the best things that happened were not recognized, more than likely. Like the stuff on the ground that was most impactful and most hopeful and by virtue of all that was the most holy, just never left a trace. And and it's not that, so this might be more reflective of our celebrity culture a little bit, but if it's not, if that's not being paid attention to, sometimes it's because a portion of the we, like the white American we, don't want to pay attention to it. Because the more we pay attention to those heroes, like even Dr. King, like the more we pay attention to the teaching and what happened there, you can't put Dr. King in context without knowing the forces against him.
Right.
And knowing that really, I said this the other day to someone, I forget, it's not as if structural racism went away. It just changed clothes.
Yeah.
And so there are whole new expressions that just continue to be pushed and propped up. But I think the restless thing for me is, at its heart, racism, especially for followers of Jesus, is a formation issue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a spiritual formation issue. So as someone who loves that, like you do, like I do, how do we move into the idea of racism as you know, there's obviously a structural, and I believe that.
Yeah.
But from a personal standpoint, how do we step into that as a formation issue rather than just a, because I hear people all the time say, well, that's a political thing. And I don't like to bring politics into my faith. To which I kind of respond, well, the crucifixion doesn't make a whole lot of sense without politics, nor does 98% of the things that Jesus said. But I don't think you can be formed without bringing your formation to everything. So for you, as someone who teaches and loves that, how do we begin to think about racism as a formation issue?
I mean, I do think it's a formation issue. I think you hit the nail right on the head. And for people to say they don't want to bring politics, oh, yes, you do, only certain politics, right? If you think about it, And I'm not trying to be mean, because maybe you didn't think about it this way. If you say Christians should only vote for X or Y because of this or whatever, then whatever side you're on, that you do bring politics into it. Yeah, I actually just think this whole school board thing, that's a very political move. Anyways, the school curriculum, I'm not going to get into that right now. I am studying it, though, very closely. I actually, so Casey, I'm just like, okay. I'm like, okay, why are there a formational issue? Like, just, I'll just use our seminary, for example, Northeastern Seminary. 43% of the people there are people of color at my seminary. And I think to myself, well, not quite 50 yet, but at least they feel comfortable. And what is it? What's a very gracious place? You know, we do have professors of color, me included. But I'm like, okay, why do people of color feel comfortable here? Well, maybe there's just a, what do you call it? That there's a word for it, but where there's so many of them that, yeah, it just keeps attracting more people, right? There's a certain amount of people, that threshold, right? You go over the threshold. But in the seminary classes, I have my students, and not just me, actually the other professors, before I ever started, so it wasn't just me. We have them read stuff like Frederick Douglass, and I recommended reading W.E. Du Bois, and, you know, even maybe Toni Morrison, right, who writes fiction, right? So I have that stuff in my curriculum, and so does the school. Like, that's part of formation. In fact, we said in our seminary, formation is part of every class. So if you're teaching New Testament, like, how does formation work into that, right? It's not just this one-off class that Marlena's teaching, right? It's like, if you're teaching counseling, which I know you're a counselor, you know, if you're, whatever you're in, how does becoming like Christ play a part? It's not just intellectual knowledge of about the New Testament. You should be formed by what you're studying and what you're learning. And so that's how I do. I'm like, okay, so I have had students are like, why am I reading this? This is not part of a spiritual formation course. I'm like, oh yes, it is. Like, you know, whatever, a book on race, because I'm like, if you, where you live, I want you to tell me where you live, where are the marginalized people? And I'm not just talking about people of color. Where are the refugees? Where are the marginalized people in your church's neighborhood? Or if you're in a house church, okay, in your neighborhood, like, why aren't they with you in your church? Or why don't you ever talk to them? Fine, they don't come to your church, but why don't you have any relationship? Because we are spiritually blind to, and to things. And so, like, and this has to do with formation, because I think formation happens in place. It's happening now and us talking, and I've met you in person, and you are what you come off as, you know, a wonderful person. But it also happens right where we live. And so, for example, I'm like, okay, why is it that the poorest houses are under Interstate 90? Like, you know, there's the bridge is right over their houses, you know, the trailers. You know, where do the refugees in my neighborhood live? Well, there's no refugees. Well, there might not be, but it's probably like, I don't know where they're at, right? Or where do they live in the Toledo area? Why don't certain people live in my neighborhood? Maybe there is not affordable housing, you know, all these things. I'm talking about race, but to me, that's just, you know, shalom, you know, biblical justice, which is justice. why isn't that? And so I bring that. So I don't just teach the, which I think are extremely important, the spiritual practices, which I think they're important, but those spiritual practices should help us to have better spiritual, and I don't want to say everything spiritual, right? Insight for humankind. So what are we going on pilgrimages for, and, you know, going into solitude and silence if we don't love our neighbors? Like, what's the point? Right. It's a part of loving your neighbor. So
yeah.
What do you think?
Well, I think you named it. So much of formation is learning more and more how to see ourselves and God and others through the lens of the kingdom.
Yes.
And kingdom as a reality that we have access to. This is where James Brand Smith and Dallas Willard have been so helpful to me in mm-hmm. the idea that the kingdom, Jesus is welcoming us to the kingdom that's available now and that we can live in it and we can order our days so that we don't have to run the world, but that we can bring our little kingdom into God's greater kingdom. Mm-hmm. And automatically doing that, we see everything differently and trying to see the world through the lens of compassion and grace and also see suffering. I think about Jesus looking at people, and this is during the feeding of the 5,000 story.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I want to lift it out of that story and just apply it to any situation, because it says Jesus looked and saw them and that they were harassed
mm-hmm.
and suffering like sheep without a shepherd. And that, you know, that feels like it's diminishing the people. It's really not.
Mm-hmm.
But what it is saying is that, are you looking for places where people don't belong or they don't mm-hmm. sense that belonging? Are you looking for places where they're harassed, where they're not taken into account? Like, how many people just saw a hillside full of rabble, you know, people who are politically ineffective and economically stunted, and those are the people who live on the hillside. And mm-hmm. what Jesus saw was a people who had experienced something. And I think we have to be formed to look at the world that way. But it's also about what do we attach to? Like, what are the things that we attach to when it comes to God, to ourselves, and to other people? What are the healthy, you know, you mentioned practices. What are the healthy practices? But what are the healthy ways, or what are the ways that we see the world that we attach to, that we connect to? Are they ones of fear and prejudice and, you know, trusting so much that the view we've had is the view everyone should have?
Mm-hmm.
Not even realizing how it's been handed down to us and shaped by things that are not in line with the kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's critiquing those things we're attached to. Mm-hmm. My wife and I went to breakfast this morning. We were having a conversation, and it's too long. I can't recount the whole thing. But ultimately, it came down to, I thought something based on a really terrible generality that I didn't even know was in my head until I mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh my gosh, this is a moment of repentance. I need mm-hmm. to change the way I think about that, because the only reason I think that is because of this story that I still have mm-hmm. a little attachment to that needs to be mm-hmm. let go of. So, and that's a restless place, because as soon as you say that, as soon as I said that this morning, I was like, oh, dang, where are the other places that I've been, like, have I recorded podcasts with that in it? Have I written that way? Probably, but mm-hmm. at least it's out there now. And so I know I can't go back and unsay those things, but how do I move forward with an attachment to a new way of seeing things? So that's how I can see that happening. And you know what? I think that's the gift that people like you, in the position that you're in, the gifts that you have, the passion that you have, the fire that you have for this, I think that's the value, mm-hmm. is that you get people who need to be detached from certain stories. It's good to be restless when it comes to that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So can I ask you, I don't know how much we have left on this podcast, but I imagine there's just people listening to this podcast or who will read your book, and just going back to belonging, like maybe they say, Casey, I don't feel like I belong because I have detached from certain ideas of the church. So I can no longer, I don't go to particular churches, or maybe I don't go to church at all because I feel like I don't want to endorse wrong ways of thinking of the world, or because I've been hurt by the church. So I don't feel like I belong among Christians, or I just don't feel I belong in general. Maybe people think I'm awkward, or, you know, maybe I have a disability of some sort and I'm excluded. What would you say to someone in that situation who desperately wants to belong, but feel, I mean, maybe they really don't belong, but sometimes we feel that we don't belong and it's part of our own things we need to work through, but it doesn't matter. That's how we feel. Mm-hmm. So what would you say to someone about that? And, you know, that restlessness, because I don't feel like I belong and maybe I never will. What would you tell them?
Yeah. I think I would start by saying what you're about to embark on is probably the most difficult and most beautiful thing that could happen to you. And obviously there are, I want to sit with that person and contemplate and talk through the different circumstances. So there is a disconnection that comes that is just that natural maturing and growing up thing. Mm-hmm. And I think the development process for human beings and the development process for us in our spiritual, our life with God, operate on kind of parallel tracks. Mm-hmm. So the things we experience in adolescence as a human are mirrored in how we experience like a spiritual adolescence. There's a rebellion and there's a, I'm just, all of this stuff I learned is terrible and you guys don't know what you're talking about. And we sort of go off on our own and go on the pilgrimage and figure that out. But ultimately I would say this is a difficult and beautiful thing. And it's learning a couple things. One, especially when it comes to God and communities of faith, it's just finding the places where we've mistaken God for the structures we've built to understand God.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's certain mystical tradition. You mentioned mystics earlier. Like, I think you're a mystic, Marlene. I could see you being a mystic. I think there are certain mystical traditions that are better at doing that. And so what I find is that people who are asking me that question have found themselves reading or stepping towards some of these desert people that they've heard about or something like that. And there's an insight there that says, God is not easily described. Mm-hmm. God is known, but not easily known. God is Father, but God is not Father. Mm-hmm. And so what you're stepping into is like all of our metaphors get right up to the place of being completely completely true, and then they fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the idea of God as Father, but God is not a father. Not in the sense that we think of it. And then I see trauma like that. I see trauma, especially in women who have had relationships with their fathers that have just been toxic and abusive.
Mm-hmm.
And they, seeing God as Father is like, yeah, if God is Father, I don't want anything to do with that.
Right.
Because here's what fathers do.
Yeah.
And so learning how we've mistaken God for our descriptions or our structures that have helped us to understand God is the first part. And that is incredibly painful. And I think that's one of the imagery from scripture of Jesus going into the wilderness mm-hmm. has so many layers to it. Because when you get to that point, and I see this happening all the time, when people are forced to break and detach from the past images of God that they carried, there's this this like lizard brain response that kicks in for us. So we either want to fight it and we mm-hmm. want to declare war on all the people who told us this was true. And we're like, that you're terrible and you're awful.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe there may be some really deep, dark threads there. Or it might be people passing on the only story they know.
Yeah.
And so I think there's that desire to like force it. I think there's the desire to just flop and say, mm-hmm. well, then I can't be a person of faith.
Yeah.
If I can't hold on to these images that were there before, then obviously I've lost the big F faith. When in all honesty, what you're doing is you're just walking away from a lowercase F kind of faith.
Yes.
Not, it's a faith, not the faith.
Yeah.
And so helping us, I mean, the ultimate short answer to that would be, I would want to help that person to sit in the middle of this. You can't go back to the attachments you used to have.
Mm-hmm.
We have no idea what to attach to moving forward. So let's just stay here for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Let's let this restlessness teach us something. Let's mm-hmm. let our loneliness teach us something. And I know that isn't easy. And... Mm-hmm. But it's a lot better. It may not be easy, but it's a lot more healthy than trying to give away a part of ourself just to solve this problem or make us feel better or just doubling down. I've heard several people who have faith transitions say, I felt like if I just doubled down on the stuff I used to believe, then everything would be fine again. And instead of becoming free, they became Pharisees.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, it is hard. And you have a lot of wisdom there. And so, yeah. And I'm not even in charge of this podcast. You are, but I hope that at least people feel like, you know what Casey says really resonates. So I'm not all alone in the world, or what Marlena says resonates. There are people that think this way and that are gracious. And I just want to remind you of that. And I, for those listening, I pray that you find people that when you look at them, you look at eyes of delight and not look down upon. So.
That's a wonderful blessing. I think we'll let that be the thing that people leave with. You are not alone. Thank you so much for sharing your time and yourself. I so appreciate you.
I appreciate you too. And I hope more people can drink of your wisdom. Thank you, Casey.
You're welcome. Marlena Graves received her MDiv from Northeastern Seminary in Rochester, New York, where she is now the Assistant Professor of Spiritual Formation. She's also pursuing her PhD in American Culture Studies at Bowling Green State University. She's been on pastoral staff at several churches, worked at not-for-profits, been on the residence life staff at a university, and worked for the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, and for migrant farm workers in the Midwest and South, and a minority community in Toledo, Ohio. She's been an adjunct professor at Weinbrenner Seminary in the area of discipleship and spiritual formation. She's also written for a wide variety of venues like Christianity Today, Relevant Magazine, and she's served as a board member for the Red Bud Writers Guild. She's the author of 3 books, including 40 Days on Being a 9, The Way Up is Down, and The Gospel of Peace in a Violent World. Links to all of this is in the show notes. Thank you for listening to the podcast. Rate and review the podcast if you haven't yet. Subscribe if you would like, and share if you don't mind. The music for today's podcast is done by my dear friend Robert Ebbins. You can find a link to his music in the show notes. Next week, the book The Gift of Restlessness that we've been talking about launches into the world. But there's still time for you to pre-order and get in on some of the pre-order gifts, so you can find a link for that in the show notes. And now, my friends, may you know that you always belong. Even when the little things you belong to change, and Spirit invites you into the difficult, beautiful work of forming new attachments that will bring you life. So go to that work today. Peace, friends.